Jesse could hear the back door banging lightly, randomly, in the October breeze blowing around the house. The jam always swelled in the fall, and you really had to give the door a yank to shut it. This time they had forgotten. She thought of telling Gerald to go back and shut the door before they got too involved, or that banging would drive her nuts. Then she thought how ridiculous that would be, given the current circumstances. It would ruin the whole mood. What mood? A good question, that. And as Gerald turned the hollow barrel of the key in the second lock, as she heard the minute click from above her left ear, she realized that for her, at least, the mood wasn't worth preserving. That was why she had noted the unlatched door in the first place, of course. For her, the sexual turn-on of the bondage games hadn't lasted long. The same could not be said of Gerald, however. He was only wearing a pair of jockey shorts now, and she didn't have to look as high as his face to see that his interest continued unabated. This is stupid, she thought. But stupid wasn't the whole story, either. It was also a little scary. She didn't like to admit it, but there it was. Gerald, why don't we just forget this? He hesitated for a moment, frowning a little, then went on across the room to the dresser which stood to the left of the bathroom door. His face cleared as he went. She watched him from where she lay on the bed, her arms raised and splayed out, making her look a little like Fay Wray, chained up and waiting for the great ape in King Kong. Her wrists had been secured to the mahogany bedposts with two sets of handcuffs. The chains gave each hand about 6 inches worth of movement. Not much. He put the keys on top of the dresser. Two minute clicks. Her ears seemed in exceptionally fine working order for a Wednesday afternoon, and then turned back to her. Over his head, sun ripples from the lake danced and wavered on the bedroom's high white ceiling. What do you say? This has lost a lot of its charm for me. And it never had that much to begin with, she did not add. He grinned. He had a heavy pink-skinned face below a narrow widow's peak of hair as black as a crow's wing, and that grin of his had always done something to her that she didn't much care for. She couldn't quite put her finger on what that something was, but, oh, sure you can. It makes him look stupid. You can practically see his IQ going down 10 points for every inch that grin spreads. At its maximum width, your killer corporate lawyer of a husband looks like a janitor on work release from the local mental institution. That was cruel, but not entirely inaccurate. But how did you tell your husband of almost 20 years that every time he grinned he looked like he was suffering from light mental retardation? The answer was simple, of course. You didn't. His smile was a different matter entirely. He had a lovely smile. She guessed it was that smile, so warm and good-humored, which had persuaded her to go out with him in the first place. It had reminded her of her father's smile when he told his family amusing things about his day as he sipped a before-dinner gin and tonic. This wasn't the smile, though. This was the grin, a version of it he seemed to save just for these sessions. She had an idea that to Gerald, who was on the inside of it, the grin felt wolfish, piratical maybe. From her angle, however, lying here with her arms raised above her head and nothing on but a pair of bikini panties, it only looked stupid. No, retarded. He was, after all, no devil-may-care adventurer like the ones in the men's magazines over which he had spent the furious ejaculations of his lonely, overweight puberty. He was an attorney with a pink, too-large face spreading below a widow's peak which was narrowing relentlessly toward total baldness. Just an attorney with a hard-on poking the front of his undershorts out of shape, and only moderately out of shape at that. The size of his erection wasn't the important thing, though. The important thing was the grin. It hadn't changed a bit, and that meant Gerald hadn't taken her seriously. She was supposed to protest. After all, that was the game. Gerald, I mean it. The grin widened. A few more of his small, inoffensive attorney's teeth came into view. His IQ tumbled another 20 or 30 points, and he still wasn't hearing her. Are you sure of that? She was. She couldn't read him like a book. She supposed it took a lot more than 17 years of marriage to get to that point. But she thought she usually had a pretty good idea of what was going through his head. She thought something would be seriously out of whack if she didn't. If that's the truth, Toots, how come he can't read you? How come he can't see this isn't just a new scene in the same old sex farce? Now it was her turn to frown slightly. She had always heard voices inside her head. She guessed everyone did, although people usually didn't talk about them any more than they talked about their bowel functions. And most of them were old friends, as comfortable as bedroom slippers. This one, however, was new, and there was nothing comfortable about it. It was a strong voice, one that sounded young and vigorous. It also sounded impatient. Now it spoke again, answering its own question. It isn't that he can't read you. It's just that sometimes, Toots, he doesn't want to. Gerald, really, I don't feel like it. Bring the keys back and unlock me. We'll do something else. I'll get on top if you want, or you can just lie there with your hands behind your head and I'll do you, you know, the other way. Are you sure you want to do that? The new voice asked. Are you really sure you want to have any sex with this man? Jessie closed her eyes, as if she could make the voice shut up by doing that. When she opened them again, Gerald was standing at the foot of the bed, the front of his shorts jutting like the prow of a ship. Well, some kid's toy boat, maybe. His grin had widened further, exposing the last few teeth, the ones with the gold fillings, on both sides. She didn't just dislike that dumb grin, she realized. She despised it. I will let you up. If you're very, very good. Can you be very, very good, Jessie? Corny, the no-bullshit voice commented. Trey Corny. He hooked his thumbs into the waistband of his underpants like some absurd gunslinger. The jockeys went down pretty fast once they got past his not inconsiderable love handles. And there it was, exposed. Not the formidable engine of love she had first encountered as a teenager in the pages of Fanny Hill, but something meek and pink and circumcised. 5 inches of completely unremarkable erection. 2 or 3 years ago, on one of her infrequent trips to Boston, she had seen a movie called The Belly of an Architect. She thought, right, and now I'm looking at the penis of an attorney. She had to bite the insides of her cheeks to keep from laughing. Laughing at this point would be impolitic. An idea came to her then, and it killed any urge she'd had to laugh. It was this. He didn't know she was serious, because for him, Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame, wife of Gerald, sister of Maddie and Will, daughter of Tom and Sally, mother of no one, was really not here at all. She had ceased to be here when the keys made their small, steely clicks in the locks of the handcuffs. The men's adventure magazines of Gerald's teenage years had been replaced by a pile of skin magazines in the bottom drawer of his desk, magazines in which women wearing pearls and nothing else knelt on bearskin rugs, while men with sexual equipment that made Gerald's look strictly H.O. scale by comparison took them from behind. In the backs of these magazines, between the Talk Dirty to Me phone ads with their 900 numbers, were ads for inflatable women which were supposed to be anatomically correct, a bizarre concept if Jessie had ever encountered one. She thought of those air-filled dollies now, their pink skins, lineless cartoon bodies, and featureless faces, with a kind of revelatory amazement. It wasn't horror, not quite, but an intense light flashed on inside her, and the landscape it disclosed was certainly more frightening than the stupid game, or the fact that this time they were playing it in the summer house by the lake, long after the summer had run away for another year. But none of it had affected her hearing in the slightest. Now it was a chainsaw she heard, snarling away in the woods at some considerable distance, as much as 5 miles, maybe. Closer by, out on the main body of Kashwakamak Lake, a loon, tardy in starting its annual run south, lifted its crazed cry into the blue October air. Closer still, somewhere here on the north shore, a dog barked. It was an ugly, ratcheting sound, but Jessie found it oddly comforting. It meant that someone else was up here, midweek in October or no. Otherwise, there was just the sound of the door, loose as an old tooth in a rotted gum, slapping at the swollen jamb. She felt that if she had to listen to that for long, it would drive her crazy. Gerald, now naked save for his spectacles, knelt on the bed and began crawling up toward her. His eyes were still gleaming. She had an idea it was that gleam which had kept her playing the game long after her initial curiosity had been satisfied. It had been years since she'd seen that much heat in Gerald's gaze when he looked at her. She wasn't bad-looking. She'd managed to keep the weight off and still had most of her figure. But Gerald's interest in her had waned just the same. She had an idea that the booze was partly to blame for that. He drank a hell of a lot more now than when they'd first been married. But she knew the booze wasn't all of it. What was the old saw about familiarity breeding contempt? That wasn't supposed to hold true for men and women in love, at least according to the romantic poets she'd read in English Lit 101. But in the years since college, she had discovered there were certain facts of life about which John Keats and Percy Shelley had never written. But of course they had both died younger than she and Gerald were now. And all of that didn't matter much right here and right now. What maybe did was that she had gone on with the game longer than she had really wanted to, because she had liked that hot little gleam in Gerald's eyes. It made her feel young and pretty and desirable. But if you really thought it was you he was seeing when he got that look in his eye, you were misled, Toots. Or maybe you misled yourself. And maybe now you have to decide, really, really decide, if you intend to continue putting up with this humiliation. Because isn't that pretty much how you feel? Humiliated? She sighed. Yes, it pretty much was. Gerald, I do mean it. She spoke louder now, and for the first time the gleam in his eyes flickered a little. Good. He could hear her after all, it seemed. So maybe things were still okay. Not great. It had been a long time since things had been what you could call great. But okay. Then the gleam reappeared, and a moment later the idiot grin followed. I'll teach you, me proud beauty, he said. He actually said that, pronouncing beauty the way the landlord in a bad Victorian melodrama might say it. Let him do it, then. Just let him do it, and it will be done. This was a voice she was much more familiar with, and she intended to follow its advice. She didn't know if Gloria Steinem would approve and didn't care. The advice had the attractiveness of the completely practical. Let him do it, and it would be done. QED. Then his hand, his soft, short-fingered hand, its flesh as pink as that which capped his penis, reached out and grasped her breast. And something inside her suddenly popped like an overstrained tendon. She bucked her hips and backed sharply upward, flinging his hand off. Quit it, Gerald! Unlock these stupid handcuffs and let me up! This stopped being fun around last March while there was still snow on the ground. I don't feel sexy, I feel ridiculous! This time he heard her all the way down. She could see it in the way the gleam in his eyes went out all at once, like candle flames in a strong gust of wind. She guessed that the two words which had finally gotten through to him were stupid and ridiculous. He had been a fat kid with thick glasses, a kid who hadn't had a date until he was 18, the year after he went on a strict diet and began to work out in an effort to strangle the engirdling flab before it could strangle him. By the time he was a sophomore in college, Gerald's life was what he described as more or less under control. As if life, his life anyway, had been a bucking bronco he had been ordered to tame. But she knew his high school years had been a horror show that had left him with a deep legacy of contempt for himself and suspicion of others. His success as a corporate lawyer and marriage to her, she believed that had also played a part, perhaps even the crucial one, had further restored his confidence and self-respect, but she supposed that some nightmares never completely ended. In a deep part of his mind, the bullies were still giving Gerald wedgies in study hall, still laughing at Gerald's inability to do anything but girly push-ups and phys ed. And there were words, stupid and ridiculous, for instance, that brought all that back as if high school had been yesterday, or so she suspected. Psychologists could be incredibly stupid about some things, almost willfully stupid, it often seemed to her. But about the horrible persistence of some memories, she thought they were bang on. Some memories battened onto a person's mind like evil leeches, and certain words, stupid and ridiculous, for example, could bring them instantly back to squirming, feverish life. She waited to feel a pang of shame at hitting below the belt like this, and was pleased, or maybe it was relief she felt, when no pang came. I guess maybe I'm just tired of pretending, she thought. And this idea led to another. She might have her own sexual agenda, and if she did, this business with the handcuffs was definitely not on it. They made her feel demeaned. The whole idea made her feel demeaned. Oh, a certain uneasy excitement had accompanied the first few experiments, the ones with the scarves. And on a couple of occasions, she'd had multiple orgasms, and that was a rarity for her. All the same, there had been side effects she didn't care for, and that feeling of being somehow demeaned was only one of them. She'd had her own nightmares following each of those early sessions of Gerald's game. She awoke from them sweaty and gasping, her hands thrust deeply into the fork of her crotch and rolled into tight little balls. She only remembered one of these dreams, and that memory was distant, blurred. She had been playing croquet without any clothes on, and all at once, the sun had gone out. Then a hand had touched her, and a horrible, scary voice had spoken out of the darkness.
"Do you love me, Pumpkin?"
it had asked. And the most horrible thing about that voice had been its familiarity. "Never mind all that, Jesse. Those are things you can consider another day. Right now, the only important thing is getting him to let you loose." Yes, because this wasn't their game. This game was all his. She had gone on playing it simply because Gerald wanted her to, and that was no longer good enough. The loon voiced its lonely cry out on the lake again. Gerald's dopey grin of anticipation had been replaced by a look of sulky displeasure. "You broke my toy, you bitch," the look said. Jessie found herself remembering the last time she'd gotten a good look at that expression. In August, Gerald had come to her with a glossy brochure, had pointed out what he wanted, and she had said yes, of course, he could buy a Porsche if he wanted a Porsche. They could certainly afford a Porsche. But she thought he might do better to buy a membership at the Forest Avenue Health Club, as he had been threatening to do for the past 2 years. "You don't have a Porsche body just now," she had said, knowing she wasn't being very diplomatic, but feeling that this really wasn't the time for diplomacy. Also, he had exasperated her to the point where she hadn't cared a whole hell of a lot for his feelings. This had been happening more and more frequently to her lately, and it dismayed her, but she didn't know what to do about it. "Just what is that supposed to mean?" he had asked stiffly. She didn't bother to answer. She had learned that when Gerald asked such questions, they were almost always rhetorical. The important message lay in the simple subtext. "You're upsetting me, Jesse. You're not playing the game." But on that occasion, perhaps in an unknowing tune-up for this one, she had elected to ignore the subtext and answer the question. "It means that you're still going to be 46 this winter, whether you own a Porsche or not, Gerald, and you're still going to be 30 pounds overweight." Cruel, yes, but she could have been downright gratuitous, could have passed on the image which had flashed before her eyes when she had looked at the photograph of the sports car on the front of the glossy brochure Gerald had handed her. In that blink of an instant, she had seen a chubby little kid with a pink face and a widow's peak stuck in the inner tube he'd brought to the old swimming hole. Gerald had snatched the brochure out of her hand and had stalked away without another word. The subject of the Porsche had not been raised since, but she had often seen it in his resentful, "we are not amused" stare. She was seeing an even hotter version of that stare right now. "You said it sounded like fun. Those were your exact words. It sounds like fun." Had she said that? She supposed she had. But it had been a mistake. A little goof, that was all. A little slip on the old banana peel, sure. But how did you tell your husband that when he had his lower lip pooched out like baby Huey getting ready to do a tantrum? She didn't know, so she dropped her gaze and saw something she didn't like at all. Gerald's version of Mr. Happy hadn't wilted a bit. Apparently, Mr. Happy hadn't heard about the change of plans. "Gerald, I just don't feel like it." "Well, that's a hell of a note, isn't it? I mean, I took the whole day off work, and if we spend the night, that means tomorrow morning off as well." He brooded over this for a moment and then repeated, "You said it sounded like fun." She began to fan out her excuses like a tired old poker hand. "Yes, but now I have a headache. Yes, but I'm having these really shitty premenstrual cramps. Yes, but I'm a woman and therefore entitled to change my mind. Yes, but now that we're actually out here in the big lonely, you frighten me, you big, bad, beautiful brute of a man, you..." The lies that fed either his misconceptions or his ego, the two were frequently interchangeable. But before she could pick a card, any card, the new voice spoke up. It was the first time it had spoken out loud, and Jessie was fascinated to find that it sounded the same in the air as it did inside her head. Strong, dry, decisive, in control. It also sounded curiously familiar. "You're right. I guess I did say that. But what really sounded like fun was breaking away with you the way we used to, before you got your name up on the door with the rest of the type A's. I thought maybe we could bounce the bed springs a little, then sit on the deck and dig the quiet. Maybe play some Scrabble after the sun went down. Is that an actionable offense, Gerald? What do you think? Tell me, because I really want to know." "But you said..." For the last 5 minutes, she had been telling him in various ways that she wanted out of these goddamn handcuffs, and he still hadn't let her out of them. Suddenly, her impatience boiled over into fury. "My God, Gerald! This stopped being fun for me almost as soon as we started, and if you weren't as thick as a brick, you would have realized it. Your mouth. Your smart, sarcastic mouth. Sometimes I get so tired. Gerald, when you get your head really set on something, Sweet and Low doesn't come close to reaching you. And whose fault is that? I don't like you when you're like this, Jessie. When you're like this, I don't like you a bit." This was going from bad to worse to horrible, and the scariest part was how fast it was happening. Suddenly, she felt very tired, and a line from an old Paul Simon song occurred to her. "I don't want no more of this crazy love." "Right on, Paul. You may be short, but you ain't dumb." "I know you don't. And it's okay that you don't, because right now the subject is these handcuffs, not how much you do or don't like me when I tell you I've changed my mind about something. I want out of these cuffs. Are you hearing me?" No, she realized with dawning dismay. He really wasn't. Gerald was still one turn back. "You are just so goddamned inconsistent, so goddamned sarcastic. I love you, Jess, but I hate the goddamn lip on you. I always have." He wiped the palm of his left hand across his pouting rosebud of a mouth, and then looked sadly at her. Poor put-upon Gerald, saddled with a woman who had gotten him out here in the forest primeval, and then reneged on her sexual obligations. Poor put-upon Gerald, who showed no sign whatever of getting the handcuff keys off the bureau by the bathroom door. Her unease had changed into something else, while her back was turned, as it were. It had become a mixture of anger and fear she could remember feeling only once before. When she was 12 or so, her brother Will had goosed her at a birthday party. All her friends had seen, and they had all laughed. "Har, har, pretty funny, signor, I think." It hadn't been funny to her, though. Will had been laughing hardest of all. So hard, he was actually doubled over with one hand planted above each knee, his hair hanging in his face. This had been a year or so after the advent of the Beatles and the Stones and the Searchers and all the rest, and Will had had a lot of hair to hang. It had apparently blocked his view of Jessie, because he had no idea of how angry she was. And he was, under ordinary circumstances, very much aware of her turns of mood and temper. He'd gone on laughing until that froth of emotion so filled her that she understood she would have to do something with it or simply explode. So she had doubled up one small fist and had punched her well-loved brother in the mouth when he finally raised his head to look at her. The blow had knocked him over like a bowling pin, and he had cried really hard. Later, she had tried to tell herself that he had cried more out of surprise than pain. But she had known, even at 12, that that wasn't so. She had hurt him. Hurt him plenty. His lower lip had split in one place, his upper lip in two, and she had hurt him plenty. And why? Because he had done something stupid? Because he'd only been 9 himself, 9 that day. And at that age, all kids were stupid. It was practically a national law. No, it hadn't been his stupidity. It had been her fear. Fear that if she didn't do something with that ugly green froth of anger and embarrassment, it would
put out the sun,
cause her to explode. The truth, first encountered on that day, was this. There was a well inside her. The water in that well was poisoned, and when he goosed her, William had sent a bucket down there, one which had come up filled with scum and squirming gluck. She had hated him for that, and she supposed it was really her hate which had caused her to strike out. That deep stuff had scared her. Now, all these years later, she was discovering it still did. But it still infuriated her as well. "You won't put out the sun," she thought, without the slightest idea of what this meant. "Be damned if you will." "I don't want to argue the fine points, Gerald. Just get the keys to these fucking things and unlock me." And then he said something which so astounded her that at first she couldn't grasp it. "What if I won't?" What registered first was the change in his tone. He usually spoke in a bluff, gruff, hearty sort of voice. "I'm in charge here, and it's a pretty lucky thing for all of us, isn't it?" that tone proclaimed. But purring voice with which she was not familiar. The gleam had returned to his eyes. That hot little gleam which had turned her on like a bank of floodlights once upon a time. She couldn't see it very well. His eyes were squinted down to puffy slits behind his gold-rimmed spectacles. But it was there. Yes, indeed. Then there was the strange case of Mr. Happy. Mr. Happy hadn't wilted a bit. Seemed, in fact, to be standing taller than at any time she could remember. Although that was probably just her imagination. Do you think so, Toots? I don't. She processed all this information before finally returning to the last thing he'd said. That amazing question. "What if I won't?" This time she got past the tone to the sense of the words, and as she came to fully understand them, she felt her rage and fear crank up a notch. Somewhere inside, that bucket was going down its shaft again for another slimy dip. A scumload of water filled with microbes almost as poisonous as swamp copperheads. The kitchen door banged against its jamb, and the dog began to bark in the woods again, sounding closer than ever now. It was a splintery, desperate sound. Listening to something like that for too long would undoubtedly give you a migraine. "Listen, Gerald," she heard her strong new voice saying. She was aware that this voice could have picked a better time to break its silence. She was, after all, out here on the deserted north shore of Kashwakamak Lake, handcuffed to the bedposts, and wearing only a skimpy pair of nylon panties. But she still found herself admiring it. Almost against her will, she found herself admiring it. "Are you listening yet? I know you don't do much of that these days, when it's me doing the talking. But this time it's really important that you hear me. So, are you finally listening?" He was kneeling on the bed, looking at her as if she were some previously undiscovered species of bug. His cheeks, in which complex networks of tiny scarlet threads squirmed, she thought of them as Gerald's liquor brands, were flushed almost purple. A similar swath crossed his forehead. Its color was so dark, its shape so definite, that it looked like a birthmark. "Yes," he said. And in his new purring voice, the word came out, "Yes. I'm listening, Jesse. I most certainly am." "Good. Then you'll walk over to the bureau and get those keys. You'll unlock this one," she rattled her right wrist against the headboard. "And then you'll unlock this one." She rattled the left wrist in similar fashion. "If you do this right away, we can have a little, normal, painless, mutual orgasm sex before returning to our normal, painless lives in Portland." Pointless, she thought. You left that one out. Normal, painless, pointless lives in Portland. Perhaps that was so, Or perhaps it was just a little over-dramatization. Being handcuffed to the bed brought that out in a person she was discovering. But it was probably just as well she'd left that one out in any case. It suggested that the new no-bullshit voice wasn't so indiscreet after all. Then, as if to contradict this idea, she heard that voice, which was after all her voice, begin to rise in the unmistakable beats and pulses of rage. "But if you continue screwing around and teasing me, I'll go straight to my sister's from here, find out who did her divorce, and call her. I'm not joking. I do not want to play this game." Now something really incredible was happening. Something she never would have suspected in a million years. His grin was resurfacing. It was coming up like a sub which has finally reached friendly waters after a long and dangerous voyage. That wasn't the really incredible thing, though. The really incredible thing was that the grin no longer made Gerald look harmlessly retarded. It now made him look like a dangerous lunatic. His hand stole out again, caressed her left breast, then squeezed it painfully. He finished this unpleasant bit of business by pinching her nipple, a thing he had never done before. "Ow, Gerald, that hurts!" He gave a solemn, appreciative nod that went very strangely with his horrible grin. "That's good, Jessie. The whole thing, I mean. You could be an actress. Or a call girl. One of the really high-priced ones." He hesitated, then added, "That's supposed to be a compliment." "What in God's name are you talking about?" Except she was pretty sure she knew. Jessie suddenly realized that she was really afraid now. Something bad was loose in the bedroom. It was spinning around and around like a black top. But she was also still angry, as angry as she had been on the day Will had goosed her. Gerald actually laughed. "What am I talking about?" For a minute there, you had me believing it. "That's what I'm talking about." He dropped a hand onto her right thigh. When he spoke again, his voice was brisk and weirdly businesslike. "Now, do you want to spread them for me, or do I have to do it? Is that part of the game, too?"
"Let me up!"
"Yes, eventually." His other hand shot out. This time it was her right breast he pinched, and this time the pinch was so hard it fired off nerves and little white sparkles all the way down her side to her hip. "For now, spread those lovely legs, me proud beauty." She took a closer look at him and saw a terrible thing. He knew. He knew she wasn't kidding about not wanting to go on with it. He knew, but he had chosen not to know he knew. Could a person do that? "You bet," the no-bullshit voice said. "If you're a hot-shot shyster in the biggest corporate law firm north of Boston and south of Montreal, I guess you can know whatever you want to know and not know whatever you don't want to know. I think you're in big trouble here, honey. The kind of trouble that ends marriages. Better grit your teeth and squint your eyes, because I think one bitch of a vaccination shot is on the way." That grin. That ugly, mean-spirited grin. Pretending ignorance, and doing it so hard that later on he would be able to pass a lie detector test on the subject. "I thought it was all part of the game," he would say, all hurt and wide-eyed. "I really did." And if she persisted, driving at him with her anger, he would eventually fall back to the oldest defense of them all, and then slip into it, like a lizard into a crack in a rock. "You liked it. You know you did. Why don't you admit it?" Pretending into ignorance. Knowing, but planning to go ahead anyway. He'd handcuffed her to the bedposts, had done it with her own cooperation. And now, oh shit, let's not gild the lily. Now he meant to rape her. Actually rape her, while the door banged and the dog barked and the chainsaw snarled and the loon yodeled out there on the lake. He really meant to do it. Yes, sir, boys. Hi-yuck, hi-yuck, hi-yuck. You ain't really had pussy until you've had pussy that's jumping around underneath you like a hen on a hot griddle. And if she did go to Maddie's when this exercise in humiliation was over, he would continue to insist that rape had been the furthest thing from his mind. He placed his pink hands against her thighs and began spreading her legs. She did not resist much, for the moment at least. She was too horrified and amazed by what was going on here to resist much. And that's exactly the right attitude, the more familiar voice inside her spoke up. Just lie there quietly and let him shoot his squirt. After all, what's the big deal? He's done it at least 1,000 times before, and you never once turned green. In case you forgot, it's been quite a few years since you were a blushing virgin. And what would happen if she didn't listen and obey the counsel of that voice? What was the alternative? As if in answer, a horrid picture rose in her mind. It was herself she saw, testifying in divorce court. She didn't know if there were still such things as divorce courts in Maine, but that in no way dimmed the vividness of the vision. She saw herself dressed in her conservative pink Donna Karan suit, with her peach silk blouse beneath it. Her knees and ankles were primly together. Her small clutch bag, the white one, was in her lap. She saw herself telling a judge who looked like the late Harry Reasoner that, yes, it was quite true she had accompanied Gerald to the summer house of her own free will. Yes, she had allowed him to tether her to the bedpost with two sets of Krieg handcuffs, also of her own free will. And yes, as a matter of fact, they had played such games before, although never at the place on the lake. Yes, Judge, yes. Yes. Gerald continued to spread her legs. Jessie heard herself telling the judge, who looked like Harry Reasoner, about how they had started with silk scarves, and how she had allowed the game to go on, progressing from scarves to ropes to handcuffs, even though she had quickly tired of the whole thing. Had, in fact, become disgusted by it. So disgusted, in fact, that she had allowed Gerald to drive her the 63 miles from Portland to Kashwakamak Lake on a weekday in October. So revolted, she had once again allowed him to chain her up like a dog. So bored with the whole thing that she had been wearing nothing but a pair of nylon panties so wispy you could have read the New York Times classified section through them. The judge would believe it all and sympathize with her most deeply. Of course he would. Who wouldn't? She could see herself sitting there on the witness stand and saying, "So there I was, handcuffed to the bedpost and wearing nothing but some underwear from Victoria's Secret and a smile, but I changed my mind at the last minute and Gerald knew it, and that makes it rape." Yes, sir, that would do her all right. Bet your boots. She came out of this appalling fantasy to find Gerald yanking at her panties. He was kneeling between her legs, his face so studious that you might have been tempted to believe it was the bar exam he was planning to take instead of his unwilling wife. There was a runner of white spittle coursing down his chin from the center of his plump lower lip. "Let him do it, Jesse. Let him shoot his squirt. It's that stuff in his balls that's making him crazy, and you know it. It makes them all crazy. When he gets rid of it, you'll be able to talk to him again. You'll be able to deal with him. So don't make a fuss. Just lie there and wait until he's got it out of his system." Good advice. And she supposed she would have followed it if not for the new presence inside her. This unnamed newcomer clearly thought that Jessie's usual source of advice, the voice she had over the years come to think of as Goodwife Burlingame, was a wimp of the highest order. Jessie still might have let things run their more or less normal course, but two things happened simultaneously. The first was her realization that although her wrists were cuffed to the bedposts, her feet and legs were free. At the same moment she realized this, the runner of drool fell off Gerald's chin. It dangled for a moment, elongating, and then fell on her midriff, just above the navel. Something about the sensation was familiar, and she was swept by a horribly intense sensation of déjà vu. The room seemed to darken around her, as if the windows in the skylight had been replaced with panes of smoked glass. It's his spunk, she thought, although she knew perfectly well it wasn't. It's his goddamn spunk. Her response was not so much directed at Gerald as at that hateful feeling that came flooding up from the bottom of her mind. In a very real sense, she acted with no thought at all, but only lashed out with the instinctive, panicky revulsion of a woman who realizes the trapped thing fluttering in her hair is a bat. She drew back her legs, her rising right knee barely missing the promontory of his chin, and then drove her bare feet out again like pistons. The sole and instep of her right drove deep into the bowl of his belly. The heel of her left smashed into the stiff root of his penis and the testicles hanging below it like pale, ripe fruit. He rocked backward, his butt coming down on his plump calves. He tilted his head up toward the skylight and the white ceiling with its reflected patterns of sun ripples and voiced a high, wheezy scream. The loon on the lake cried out again just then in hellish counterpoint. To Jesse, it sounded like one male commiserating with another. Gerald's eyes weren't slitted now. They weren't gleaming, either. They were wide open. They were as blue as today's flawless sky. The thought of seeing that sky over the autumn-empty lake had been the deciding factor when Gerald had called from the office and said he'd had a postponement, and would she like to go up to the summer place, at least for the day and maybe overnight. And the expression in them was an agonized glare she could hardly look at. Cords of tendon stood out on the sides of his neck. Jesse thought, I haven't seen those since the rainy summer when he pretty much gave up gardening and made J.W. Dant his hobby instead. His scream began to fade. It was as if someone with a special remote Gerald control were turning down his volume. That wasn't it, of course. He had been screaming for an extraordinarily long time, perhaps as long as 30 seconds, and he was just running out of breath. I must have hurt him badly, she thought. The red spots on his cheeks and the swath across his forehead were now turning purple. You did, the good wife's dismayed voice cried. You really, really did. Yup, damn good shot, wasn't it? The new voice mused. You kicked your husband in the balls, the good wife screamed. What in God's name gives you the right to do something like that? What gives you the right to even joke about it? She knew the answer to that one, or thought she did. She'd done it because her husband had intended to commit rape and pass it off later as a missed signal between two essentially harmonious marriage partners who had been playing a harmless sex game. It was the game's fault, he would have said, shrugging. The game's, not mine. We don't have to play it again, Jess, if you don't want to. Knowing, of course, that nothing he could offer would ever cause her to hold her wrists up for the handcuffs again. No. This had been a case of last time pays for all. Gerald had known it, and had intended to make the most of it. That black thing she had sensed in the room had spun out of control, just as she feared it might. Gerald still appeared to be screaming, although no sound at all, at least none that she could hear, was now coming out of his pursed, agonized mouth. His face had become so congested with blood that it actually appeared to be black in places. She could see his jugular vein, or maybe it was his carotid artery, if that mattered at a time like this, pulsing furiously beneath the carefully shaved skin of his throat. Whichever one it was, it looked ready to explode, and a nasty jolt of terror stabbed Jesse. Gerald? Her voice sounded thin and uncertain. Gerald, are you all right? It was a stupid question, of course, incredibly stupid, but it was a lot easier to ask than the ones that were really on her mind. Gerald, how badly are you hurt? Gerald, do you think you might die? Of course he's not going to die, the good wife said nervously. You heard him, indeed you have, and you ought to be sorry, but he's not going to die. Nobody's going to die around here. Gerald's pursed, puckered mouth continued to quiver soundlessly, but he didn't answer her question. One of his hands had gone to his belly. The other had cupped his wounded testes. Now they both rose slowly and settled just above his left nipple. They settled like a pair of pudgy pink birds too tired to fly farther. Jessie could see the shape of a bare foot, her bare foot, rising on her husband's round stomach. It was a bright, accusatory red against his pink flesh. He was exhaling, or trying to, sending out a dour fog that smelled like rotting onions. That's tidal breath, she thought. The bottom 10% of our lungs is reserved for tidal breath. Isn't that what they taught us in high school biology? Yes, I think so. Tidal breath, the fabled last gasp of drowners and chokers. Once you expel that, you either faint or... Gerald! She cried in a sharp, scolding voice. Gerald, breathe! His eyes bulged from their sockets like blue marbles stuck in an unlovely clod of Play-Doh, and he did manage to drag in a single small sip of air. He used it to speak a final word to her, this man who had sometimes seemed made of words. Heart. That was all. Gerald! Now she sounded shocked as well as scolding. An old maid schoolteacher who has caught the second-grade flirt pulling up her skirt to show the boys the bunnies on her underpants. Gerald, stop fooling around and breathe, goddammit! Gerald didn't. Instead, his eyes rolled back in their sockets, disclosing yellowish whites that looked like the whites of bloody eggs. His tongue blew out of his mouth with a noisome farting sound. A stream of cloudy, orange-tinted urine arced out of his deflated penis, and her knees and thighs were doused with feverishly hot droplets. Jessie voiced a long, piercing shriek. This time she was unaware of yanking against the handcuffs, of using them to draw herself as far back from him as possible, awkwardly curling her legs beneath her as she did so.
Stop it, Gerald! Just stop it before you fall off the bed!
Too late. Even if he was still hearing her, which her rational mind doubted, it was too late. His bowed back arched the top half of his body beyond the edge of the bed, and gravity took over. Gerald Burlingame, with whom Jessie had once eaten creamsicles in bed, fell over backward with his knees up and his head down, like a clumsy kid trying to impress his friends during free swim at the YMCA pool. The sound of his skull meeting the hardwood bedroom floor made her shriek again. It sounded like some enormous egg being cracked against the lip of a stone bowl. She would have given anything not to have heard that. Then there was silence, broken only by the distant roar of a chainsaw. A large gray rose was opening in the air before Jessie's wide eyes. The petals spread and spread, and when they closed around her again like the dusty wings of huge colorless moths, locking out everything for a while, the only clear feeling she had was one of gratitude. She seemed to be in a long, cold hall filled with white fog, a hall that was canted severely to one side, like the halls people were always walking down in movies like A Nightmare on Elm Street and TV shows like The Twilight Zone. She was naked, and the cold was really getting to her, making her muscles ache, particularly those of her back and neck and shoulders. I've got to get out of here or I'll be sick, she thought. I'm already getting cramps from the fog and the damp, although she knew it was not the fog and the damp. Also, something's wrong with Gerald. I can't remember exactly what it is, but I think he might be sick. Although she knew that sick wasn't exactly the right word. But, and this was odd, another part of her really didn't want to escape the tilted, foggy corridor at all. This part suggested that she'd be a lot better off staying here, that if she left, she'd be sorry. So she did stay for a while. What finally got her going again was a barking dog. It was an exceedingly ugly bark, bottom heavy but breaking to shrill bits in its upper registers. Each time the animal let go with it, it sounded as if it were puking up a throat full of sharp splinters. She had heard that bark before, although it might be better, quite a bit better, actually, if she managed not to remember when, or where, or what had been happening at the time. But at least it got her moving, left foot, right foot, hay foot, straw foot. And suddenly it occurred to her that she could see through the fog better if she opened her eyes. So she did. It wasn't some spooky Twilight Zone hallway she saw. but the master bedroom of their summer house on the north end of Kashwakamak Lake, the area that was known as Notch Bay. She guessed the reason she had felt cold was because she was wearing nothing but a pair of bikini underpants, and her neck and shoulders hurt because she was handcuffed to the bedposts, and her bottom had slid down the bed when she fainted. No tilted corridor, no foggy damp. Only the dog was real, still barking its fool head off. It now sounded quite close to the house. If Gerald heard that... The thought of Gerald made her twitch, and the twitch sent complex spiral sparkles of feeling through her cramped biceps and triceps. These tingles faded away to nothing at her elbows, and Jessie realized, with soupy, just-waking-up dismay, that her forearms were mostly without feeling, and her hands might as well have been gloves stuffed with congealed mashed potatoes. This is going to hurt, she thought. And then everything came back to her, especially the image of Gerald doing his header off the side of the bed. Her husband was on the floor, either dead or unconscious, and she was lying up here on the bed thinking about what a drag it was that her lower arms and hands had gone to sleep. How selfish and self-centered could you get? If he's dead, it's his own damned fault, the no-bullshit voice said. It tried to add a few other home truths as well, but Jessie gagged it. In her still not quite conscious state, she had a clearer sightline into the deeper archives of her memory banks, and she suddenly realized whose voice, slightly nasal, clipped, always on the verge of a sarcasm-tinged laugh, that was. It belonged to her college roommate, Ruth Neary. Now that Jessie knew, she found she wasn't a bit surprised. Ruth had always been extremely generous with pieces of her mind, and her advice had often scandalized her 19-year-old wet-behind-the-ears roommate from Falmouth Forside, which had undoubtedly been the idea, or part of it. Ruth's heart had always been in the right place, and Jessie had never doubted that Ruth actually believed 60% of the things she said, and had actually done 40% of the things she claimed to have done. When it came to things sexual, the percentage was probably even higher. Ruth Neary, the first woman Jessie had ever known who absolutely refused to shave her legs and her armpits. Ruth, who had once filled an unpleasant floor counselor's pillowcase with strawberry-scented foam douche. Ruth, who went to every student rally and attended every experimental student play on general principles. If all else fails, Tootsie, some good-looking guy will probably take his clothes off, she had told an amazed but fascinated Jessie after coming back from a student effort titled The Son of Noah's Parrot. I mean, it doesn't always happen, but it usually does. I think that's really what student-written and produced plays are for, so guys and girls can take off their clothes and make out in public. She hadn't thought of Ruth in years, and now Ruth was inside her head, handing out little nuggets of wisdom just as she had in the days of yore. Well, why not? Who was more qualified to advise the mentally confused and emotionally disturbed than Ruth Neary, who had gone on from the University of New Hampshire to 3 marriages, 2 suicide attempts, and 4 drug and alcohol rehabs? Good old Ruth, just another shining example of how well the erstwhile love generation was making the transition to middle age. Jesus, just what I need. Dear Abby from hell, she said, and the thick, slurry quality of her voice frightened her more than the lack of feeling in her hands and lower arms. She tried to yank herself back up to the mostly sitting position she had managed just before Gerald's little diving exhibition. Had that horrible egg-cracking sound been part of her dream? She prayed that it had been, and thoughts of Ruth were swallowed by a sudden burst of panic when she did not move at all. Those tingling spirals of sensation spun through her muscles again, but nothing else happened. Her arms just went on hanging above and slightly behind her, as moveless and feelingless as stove lengths of rock maple. The muzzy feeling in her head disappeared. Panic beat the hell out of smelling salt, she was discovering, and her heart kicked into a higher gear, but that was all. A vivid image culled from some long-ago history test flickered behind her eyes for a moment. A circle of laughing, pointing people standing around a young woman with her head and hands in stocks. The woman was bent over like a hag in a fairy tale, and her hair hung in her face like a penitent's shroud. Her name is Goodwife Burlingame, and she's being punished for hurting her husband, she thought. They're punishing the good wife because they can't get a hold of the one who's really responsible for hurting him. The one who sounds like my old college roommate. But was hurting the right word? Was it not likely that she was now sharing this bedroom with a dead man? Was it not also likely that, dog or no dog, the Notch Bay end of the lake was entirely deserted? That if she started to scream, she would be answered only by the loon? Only that and nothing more? It was mostly that thought, with its strange echo of Poe's The Raven, that brought her to a sudden realization of just what was going on here, what she had gotten herself into, and full-fledged, mindless terror suddenly fell on her. For 20 seconds or so, if asked how long that panic attack lasted, she would have guessed at least 3 minutes and probably closer to 5. She was totally in its grip. A thin rod of rational consciousness remained deep inside her, but it was helpless. Only a dismayed spectator watching the woman writhe on the bed with her hair flying as she whipped her head from side to side in a gesture of negation, hearing her hoarse, frightened screams. A deep, glassy pain at the base of her neck, just above the place where her left shoulder started, put a stop to it. It was a muscle cramp, a bad one, what the jocks call a Charlie horse. Moaning, Jessie let her head fall back against the separated mahogany slats which formed the headboard of the bed. The muscle she had strained was frozen in a strenuous, flexed position, and it felt as hard as a rock. The fact that her exertion had forced pins and needles of feeling all the way down her forearms to the palms of her hands meant little next to that terrible pain, and she found that leaning back against the headboard was only putting more pressure on the overstrained muscle. Moving instinctively, without any thought at all, Jessie planted her heels against the mattress, raised her buttocks, and shoved with her feet. Her elbows bent, and the pressure on her shoulders and upper arms eased. A moment later, the Charlie horse in her deltoid muscle began to let go. She let out her breath in a long, harsh sigh of relief. The wind, it had progressed quite a bit beyond the breeze stage, she noticed, gusted outside, sighing through the pines on the slope between the house and the lake. Just off the kitchen, which was in another universe as far as Jessie was concerned, the door she and Gerald had neglected to pull shut banged against the swollen jamb. One time, two time, three time, four. These were the only sounds, only these and nothing more. The dog had quit barking, at least for the time being, and the chainsaw had quit roaring. Even the loon seemed to be on its coffee break. The image of the lake loon taking a coffee break, maybe floating in the water cooler and chatting up a few of the lady loons, caused a dusty croaking sound in her throat. Under less unpleasant circumstances, that sound might have been termed a chuckle. It dissolved the last of her panic, leaving her still afraid, but at least in charge of her thoughts and actions once more. It also left her with an unpleasant metallic taste on her tongue. That's adrenaline, Toots, or whatever glandular secretion your body dumps when you sprout claws and start climbing the walls. If anyone ever asks you what panic is, now you can tell them. An emotional blank spot that leaves you feeling as if you've been sucking on a mouthful of pennies. Her forearms were buzzing, and the tingles of sensation had at last spread into her fingers as well. Jessie rolled her hands open and closed several times, wincing as she did so. She could hear the faint sound of the handcuff chains rattling against the bedposts, and took a moment to wonder if she and Gerald had been mad. It certainly seemed so now, although she had no doubt that thousands of people all over the world played similar games each and every day. She had read that there were even sexual free spirits who hung themselves in their closets and then beat off as the blood supply to their brains slowly decreased to nothing. Such news only served to increase her belief that men were not so much gifted with penises as cursed with them. But if it had been only a game, only that and nothing more, why had Gerald felt it necessary to buy real handcuffs? That was sort of an interesting question, wasn't it? Maybe. But I don't think it's the really important question just now, Jessie, do you? Ruth Neary asked from inside her head. It was really quite amazing how many different tracks the human mind could work on at the same time. On one of these, she now found herself wondering what had become of Ruth, whom she had last seen 10 years ago. It had been at least 3 years since Jessie had heard from her. The last communication had been a postcard showing a young man in an ornate red velvet suit with a ruff at the neck. The young man's mouth was open, and his long tongue had been protruding suggestively. "Someday my prince will tongue," the card had said. New Age wit, Jesse remembered thinking at the time. The Victorians had Anthony Trollope. The Lost Generation had H.L. Mencken. We got stuck with dirty greeting cards and bumper sticker witticisms like, "As a matter of fact, I do own the road." The card had borne a blurry Arizona postmark, and the information that Ruth had joined a lesbian commune. Jesse hadn't been terribly surprised at the news, had even mused that perhaps her old friend, who could be wildly irritating and surprisingly wistfully sweet, sometimes in the same breath, had finally found the hole in the great game board of life which had been drilled to accept her own oddly shaped peg. She had put Ruth's card in the top left drawer of her desk, the only one where she kept various odd lots of correspondence which would probably never be answered, and that had been the last time she'd thought about her old roomie until now. Ruth Neary, who lusted to own a Harley-Davidson barn burner, but who had never been able to master any standard transmission, even the one on Jesse's tame old Ford Pinto. Ruth, who often got lost on the UNH campus, even after 3 years there. Ruth, who always cried when she forgot she was cooking something on the hot plate and burned it to a crisp. She did that last so often, it was really a miracle she had never set their room or the whole dorm on fire. How odd that the confident, no-bullshit voice in her head should turn out to be Ruth's. The dog began to bark again. It sounded no closer, but it sounded no further away either. Its owner wasn't hunting birds, that was for sure. No hunter would have anything to do with such a canine blabbermouth. And if dog and master were out for a simple afternoon walk, how come the barks had been coming from the same place for the last 5 minutes or so? "Because you were right before," her mind whispered. "There is no master." This voice wasn't Ruth's or Goodwife Burlingame's, and it certainly wasn't what she thought of as her own voice, whatever that was. It was very young and very scared. And like Ruth's voice, it was strangely familiar. "It's just a stray out there on its own. It won't help you, Jesse. It won't help us." But that was maybe too gloomy an assessment. After all, she didn't know the dog was a stray, did she? Not for sure. And until she did, she refused to believe it. "If you don't like it, sue me," she said in a low, hoarse voice. Meanwhile, there was the question of Gerald. In her panic and subsequent pain, he had kind of slipped her mind. "Gerald?" Her voice sounded dusty, not really there. She cleared her throat and tried again. "Gerald!" Nothing. Zilch. No response at all. "That doesn't mean he's dead, though, so keep your fur on, woman. Don't go off on another rip." She was keeping her fur on, thank you very much, and she had no intention whatever of going off on another rip. All the same, she felt a deep, welling dismay in her vitals, a feeling that was like some awful homesickness. Gerald's lack of response didn't mean he was dead, that was true, but it did mean he was unconscious, at the very least. "And probably dead," Ruth Neary added. "I don't want to piss on your parade, Jess, really, but you don't hear him breathing, do you? I mean, you usually can hear unconscious people breathing. They take these big, snory, blubbery snatches of air, don't they?" "How the fuck would I know?" she said. But that was stupid. She knew because she had been an enthusiastic candy striper for most of her high school years, and it didn't take long for you to get a pretty good fix on what dead sounded like. It sounded like nothing at all. Ruth had known all about the time she had spent in Portland City Hospital, what Jesse herself had sometimes called the bedpan years. But this voice would have known it even if Ruth hadn't, because this voice wasn't Ruth. This voice was her. She had to keep reminding herself of that, because this voice was so weirdly its own self. "Like the voices you heard before," the young voice murmured. "The voices you heard after the dark day." But she didn't want to think about that. Never wanted to think about that. Didn't she have enough problems already? But Ruth's voice was right. Unconscious people, especially those who'd gotten unconscious as a result of a good hard rap on the head, usually did snore. Which meant... He's probably dead, she said in her dusty voice. Okay. Yeah. She leaned to the left, moving carefully, mindful of the muscle which had cramped so painfully at the base of her neck on that side. She had not quite reached the furthest extent of the chain binding her right wrist when she saw one pink, chubby arm and a half of one hand. The last two fingers, actually. It was his right hand. She knew this because there was no wedding ring on his third finger. She could see the white crescents of his nails. Gerald had always been very vain about his hands and his nails. She had never realized just how vain until right now. It was funny how little you saw sometimes. How little you saw even after you thought you'd seen it all. I suppose. But I'll tell you one thing, sweetie. Right now you can pull down the shades, because I don't want to see any more. No, not one thing more. But refusing to see was a luxury in which she could not, at least for the time being, indulge. Continuing to move with exaggerated care, babying her neck and shoulder, Jessie slid as far to the left as the chain would allow. It wasn't much, another 2 or 3 inches tops, but it fattened the angle enough for her to see part of Gerald's upper arm, part of his right shoulder, and a tiny bit of his head. She wasn't sure, but she thought she could also see tiny bits of blood at the edges of his thinning hair. She supposed it was at least technically possible that this last was just imagination. She hoped so.
Gerald? She whispered. Gerald, can you hear me? Please say you can.
No answer. No movement. She could feel that deep, homesick dismay again, welling and welling like an unstanched wound.
Gerald?
She whispered again.
Why are you whispering? He's dead.
The man who once surprised you with a weekend trip to Aruba, Aruba of all places, and once wore your alligator shoes on his ears at a New Year's Eve party. That man is dead. So just why in the hell are you whispering?
Gerald!
This time she screamed his name.
Gerald, wake up!
The sound of her own screaming voice almost sent her into another panicky, convulsive interlude. And the scariest part wasn't Gerald's continued failure to move or respond. It was the realization that the panic was still there, still right there, restlessly circling her conscious mind as patiently as a predator might circle the guttering campfire of a woman who has somehow wandered away from her friends and gotten lost in the deep, dark fastnesses of the woods. "You're not lost," Goodwife Burlingame said. But Jessie did not trust that voice. Its control sounded bogus. Its rationality only paint deep.
You know just where you are.
Yes, she did. She was at the end of a twisting, rutted camp road which split off from Bay Lane 2 miles south of here. The camp road had been an aisle of fallen red and yellow leaves over which she and Gerald had driven, and those leaves were mute testimony to the fact that this spur, leading to the Notch Bay end of Kashwakamak, had been used little or not at all in the last 3 weeks since the leaves had first begun to turn and then to fall. This end of the lake was almost exclusively the domain of summer people, and for all Jessie knew, the spur might not have been used since Labor Day. It was a total of 5 miles, first along the spur and then along Bay Lane, before one came out on Route 117, where there were a few year-round homes. I'm out here alone. My husband is lying dead on the floor, and I'm handcuffed to the bed. I can scream until I turn blue, and it won't do me any good. No one is going to hear. The guy with the chainsaw is probably the closest, and he's at least 4 miles away. He might even be on the other side of the lake. The dog would hear me, but the dog is almost certainly astray. Gerald's dead, and that's a shame. I never meant to kill him if that's what I did. But at least it was relatively quick for him. It won't be quick for me. If no one in Portland starts to worry about us, and there's no real reason why anyone should, at least for a while. She shouldn't be thinking this way. It brought the panic thing closer. If she didn't get her mind out of this rut, she would soon see the panic thing's stupid, hungry red eyes. No, she absolutely shouldn't be thinking this way. The bitch of it was, once you got it started, it was very hard to stop again. But maybe it's what you deserve. The hectoring, feverish voice of Goody Burlingame suddenly spoke up. Maybe it is. Because you did kill him, Jesse. You can't kid yourself about that, because I won't let you. I'm sure he wasn't in very good shape, and I'm sure it would have happened sooner or later anyway. Heart attack at the office, or maybe in the turnpike passing lane on his way home some night. Him with a cigarette in his hand trying to light it, and a big ten-wheeler behind him honking for him to get the hell back over into the right-hand lane and make some room. But you couldn't wait for sooner or later, could you? Oh, no, not you. Not Tom Mayhood's good little girl, Jessie. You couldn't just lie there and let him shoot his squirt, could you? Cosmo girl Jessie Burlingame says, no man chains me down. You had to kick him in the guts and the nuts, didn't you? And you had to do it while his thermostat was already well over the red line. Let's cut to the chase, dear. You murdered him. So maybe you deserve to be right here, handcuffed to this bed. Maybe. Oh, that is such bullshit, she said. It was an inexpressible relief to hear that other voice, Ruth's voice, come out of her mouth. She sometimes, well, maybe often, would be closer to the truth, hated the goodwife voice, hated it and feared it. It was often foolish and flighty, she recognized that, but it was also strong, so hard to say no to. Goody was always eager to assure her she had bought the wrong dress, or that she had chosen the wrong caterer for the end-of-the-summer party Gerald threw each year for the other partners in the firm and their wives. Except it was really Jessie who threw it. Gerald was just the guy who stood around and said, "Aw, shucks," and took all the credit. Goody was the one who always insisted that she had to lose 5 pounds. That voice wouldn't let up even if her ribs were showing. "Never mind your ribs," it screamed in tones of self-righteous horror. "Look at your tits, old girl. And if they aren't enough to make you barf a keg, look at your thighs. Such bullshit," she said, trying to make it even stronger. But now she heard a minute shake in her voice, and that wasn't so good. Not so good at all. He knew I was serious. He knew it. So whose fault does that make it? But was that really true? In a way it was. She had seen him deciding to reject what he saw in her face and heard in her voice because it would spoil the game. But in another way, a much more fundamental way, she knew it wasn't true at all. Because Gerald hadn't taken her seriously about much of anything during the last 10 or 12 years of their life together. He had made what almost amounted to a second career out of not hearing what she said, unless it was about meals or where they were supposed to be at such and such a time on such and such a night, so don't forget, Gerald. The only other exceptions to the general rules of ear were unfriendly remarks about his weight or his drinking. He heard the things she had to say on those subjects, and he didn't like them. But they were dismissible as part of some mythic natural order. Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly, wife gotta nag. So what exactly had she expected from this man? For him to say, "Yes, dear, I will free you at once, and by the way, thanks for raising my consciousness"? Yes, she suspected some naive part of her, some untouched and dewy-eyed little girl part, had expected just that. The chainsaw, which had been snarling and ripping away again for quite some time, suddenly fell silent. Dog, loon, and even the wind had also fallen silent, at least temporarily, and the quiet felt as thick and as palpable as 10 years of undisturbed dust in an empty house. She could hear no car or truck engine, not even a distant one. And now the voice which spoke belonged to no one but herself. "Oh, my God," it said. "Oh, my God. I am all alone out here. I am all alone." Jessie closed her eyes tightly. 6 years ago, she had spent an abortive 4-month period in counseling, not telling Gerald because she knew he would be sarcastic, and probably worried about what beans she might be spilling. She had stated her problem as stress, and Nora Callaghan, her therapist, had taught her a simple relaxation technique. "Most people associate counting to 10 with Donald Duck trying to keep his temper," Nora had said. But what a 10 count really does is to give you a chance to reset all your emotional dials. And anybody who doesn't need an emotional reset at least once a day has probably got problems a lot more serious than yours or mine. This voice was also clear. Clear enough to raise a small, wistful smile on her face. I liked Nora. I liked her a lot. Had she, Jessie, known that at the time? She was moderately astounded to find she couldn't exactly remember, any more than she could exactly remember why she had quit going to see Nora on Tuesday afternoons. She supposed that a bunch of stuff, community chest, the Court Street homeless shelter, maybe the new library fund drive, had just come up all at once. Shit happens, as another piece of New Age vapidity passing for wisdom pointed out. Quitting had probably been for the best, anyway. If you didn't draw the line somewhere, therapy just went on and on until you and your therapist dotted off to that great group encounter session in the sky together. Never mind, go ahead and do the count, starting with your toes. Do it just the way she taught you. Yes, why not? One is for feet, 10 little toes, cute little piggies all in a row. Except that 8 were comically croggled, and her great toes looked like the heads on a pair of ball-peen hammers. 2 is for legs, lovely and long. Well, not that long. She was only 5'6", after all. But Gerald had claimed they were still her best feature, at least in the old sex appeal department. She had always been amused by this claim, which seemed to be perfectly sincere on his part. He had somehow missed her knees, which were as ugly as the knobs on an apple tree, and her chubby upper thighs. 3 is my sex. What's right can't be wrong. Mildly cute. A little too cute, many might say, but not very illuminating. She raised her head a little as if to look at the object in question, but her eyes remained closed. She didn't need her eyes to see it anyway. She had been coexisting with that particular accessory for a long time. What lay between her hips was a triangle of ginger-colored, crinkly hair surrounded by an unassuming slit, with all the aesthetic beauty of a badly healed scar. This thing, this organ that was really little more than a deep fold of flesh cradled by crisscrossing belts of muscle, seemed to her an unlikely wellspring from myth, but it certainly held mythic status in the collective male mind. It was the magic veil, wasn't it? The corral where even the wildest unicorns were eventually penned. Mother McCree, what bullshit, she said, smiling a little but not opening her eyes. Except it wasn't bullshit, not entirely. That slit was the object of every man's lust, the heterosexual ones at least. But it was also frequently an object of their inexplicable scorn, distrust, and hate. You didn't hear that dark anger in all their jokes, but it was present in enough of them, and in some it was right out front, raw as a sore. What's a woman? A life support system for a cunt. Stop it, Jessie, Goodwife Burlingame ordered. Her voice was upset and disgusted. Stop it right now. That, Jessie decided, was a damned good idea, and she turned her mind back to Nora's 10 count. 4 was for her hips, too wide, and 5 her belly, too thick. 6 was her breasts, which she thought were her best feature. Gerald, she suspected, was a bit put off by the vague tracings of blue veins beneath their smoothly sloping curves. The breasts of the gatefold girls in his magazines did not show such hints of the plumbing beneath. The magazine girls didn't have tiny hairs growing out of their areoli, either. 7 was her 2 wide shoulders. 8 was her neck, which used to be good-looking but had grown decidedly chickeny in the last few years. 9 was her receding chin, and 10...
Wait a minute! Wait just one goddamn minute here!
The no-bullshit voice broke in furiously.
What kind of dumb game is this?
Jessie shut her eyes tighter, appalled by the depth of anger in that voice and frightened by its separateness. In its anger, it didn't seem like a voice coming from the central taproot of her mind at all, but like a real interloper, an alien spirit that wanted to possess her the way the spirit of Panzuzu had possessed the little girl in The Exorcist.
Don't want to answer that?
Ruth Neary, alias Panzuzu, asked.
Okay, maybe that one's too complicated. Let me make it really simple for you, Jess. Who turned Nora Callaghan's simple little relaxation litany into a mantra of self-hatred? No one, she thought back meekly, and knew at once that the no-bullshit voice would never accept that,
so she added. The good wife, it was her. No, it wasn't. Ruth's voice returned at once. She sounded disgusted at this half-assed effort to shift the blame. Goody's a little stupid, and right now she's a lot scared, but she's a sweet enough thing at the bottom, and her intentions have always been good. The intentions of whoever re-edited Nora's list were actively evil. Jesse, don't you see that? Don't you... I don't see anything because my eyes are closed, she said in a trembling, childish voice. She almost opened them, but something told her that was apt to make the situation worse instead of better. Who was the one, Jesse? Who taught you that you were ugly and worthless? Who picked out Gerald Burlingame as your soulmate in Prince Charming, probably years before you actually met him at that Republican Party mixer? Who decided he wasn't only what you needed, but exactly what you deserved? With a tremendous effort, Jessie swept this voice, all the voices she fervently hoped, out of her mind. She began the mantra again, this time speaking it aloud. One is my toes, all in a row. Two is my legs, lovely and long. Three is my sex, what's right can't be wrong. Four is my hips, curving and sweet. Five is my stomach, where I store what I eat. She couldn't remember the rest of the rhymes, which was probably a mercy. She had a strong suspicion that Nora had wamped them up herself, probably with an eye toward publication in one of the soft and yearning self-help magazines which sat on the coffee table in her waiting room, and so went on without them. Six is my breasts. Seven's my shoulders. Eight's my neck. She paused to take a breath and was relieved to find her heartbeat had slowed from a gallop to a fast run. Nine is my chin, and 10 is my eyes. Eyes open wide. She suited the action to the words, and the bedroom jumped into bright existence around her, somehow new, and for the moment at least, almost as delightful as it had been to her when she and Gerald had spent their first summer in this house. Back in 1979, a year which once had the ring of science fiction and now seemed impossibly antique. Jessie looked at the gray barnboard walls, the high white ceiling with its reflected shimmers from the lake, and the two big windows, one on either side of the bed. The one to her left looked west, giving a view of the deck, the sloping land beyond it, and the heartbreaking bright blue of the lake. The one on her right provided a less romantic vista, the driveway in her gray dowager of a Mercedes, now 8 years old and beginning to show the first small speckles of rust along the rocker panels. Directly across the room, she saw the framed batik butterfly hanging on the wall over the dresser, and remembered with a superstitious lack of surprise that it had been a 30th birthday present from Ruth. She couldn't see the tiny signature stitched in red thread from over here, but she knew it was there. Neary, 83. Another science fiction year. Not far from the butterfly, and clashing like mad, although she had never quite summoned enough nerve to point this out to her husband, Gerald's Alpha Gamma Rho Bierstein hung from a chrome peg. Rho wasn't a very bright star in the fraternity universe. The other frat rats used to call it Alpha Grabaho, but Gerald wore that pin with a perverse sort of pride, and kept the stein on the wall and drank the first beer of the summer out of it each year when they came down here in June. It was the sort of ceremony that had sometimes made her wonder, long before today's festivities, if she had been mentally competent when she married Gerald. Somebody should have put a stop to it, she thought drearily. Somebody really should have, because just look how it turned out. In the chair on the other side of the bathroom door, she could see the saucy little culotte skirt and the sleeveless blouse she had worn down on this unseasonably warm fall day. Her bra hung on the bathroom doorknob, and lying across the bedspread in her legs, turning the tiny soft hairs on her upper thighs to golden wires, was a bright band of afternoon sunlight. Not the square of light that lay almost dead center on the bedspread at 1 o'clock, and not the rectangle which lay on it at 2. This was a wide band that would soon narrow to a stripe, and although a power outage had buggered the readout of the digital clock radio on the dresser, it flashed 12 a.m. over and over, as relentless as a neon bar sign. The band of light told her it was going on 4 o'clock. Before long, the stripe would start to slide off the bed, and she would see shadows in the corners and under the little reading table over by the wall. And as the stripe became a string, first slipping across the floor and then climbing up the far wall, fading as it went. Those shadows would begin to creep out of their places and spread across the room like ink stains, eating the light as they grew. The sun was westering. In another hour, an hour and a half at most, it would be going down. 40 minutes or so after that, it would be dark. This thought didn't cause panic, at least not yet. But it did lay a membrane of gloom over her mind and a dank atmosphere of dread over her heart. She saw herself lying here, handcuffed to the bed with Gerald dead on the floor beside and below her. Saw them lying here in the dark long after the man with a chainsaw had gone back to his wife and kids and well-lighted home. And the dog had wandered away, and there was only that damned loon out there on the lake for company. Only that, and nothing more. Mr. and Mrs. Gerald Burlingame, spending one last long night together. Looking at the beer stein and the batik butterfly, unlikely neighbors which could only be tolerated in a one-season-a-year house such as this one, Jessie thought that it was easy to think about the past, and just as easy, although a lot less pleasant, to go wandering off into possible versions of the future. The really tough job seemed to be staying in the present, but she thought she'd better try her best to do it. This nasty situation was probably going to get a lot nastier if she didn't. She couldn't depend on some deus ex machina to help her get out of the jam she was in. That was a bummer. But if she succeeded in doing it herself, there would be a bonus. She'd be saved the embarrassment of lying here almost starkers while some sheriff's deputy unlocked her, asked what the hell had happened, and got a nice long look at the new widow's fair white body, all at the same time. There were two other things going on as well. She would have given a lot to push them away, even temporarily, but she couldn't. She needed to go to the bathroom, and she was thirsty. Right now, the need to ship was stronger than the need to receive, but it was her desire for a drink of water that worried her. It wasn't a big deal yet, but that would change if she wasn't able to shuck the cuffs and get to a faucet. It would change in ways she didn't like to think of. It'd be funny if I died of thirst 200 yards from the 9th biggest lake in Maine, she thought. And then she shook her head. This wasn't the 9th biggest lake in Maine. What had she been thinking of? That was Dark Score Lake, the one where she and her parents and her brother and sister had gone all those years ago. Back before the voices. Back before... She cut that off, hard. It had been a long time since she'd thought about Dark Score Lake, and she didn't intend to start now, handcuffs or no handcuffs. Better to think about being thirsty. What's to think about, Toots? It's psychosomatic, that's all. You're thirsty because you know you can't get up and get a drink. It's as simple as that. But it wasn't. She'd had a fight with her husband, and the two swift kicks she'd dealt him had started a chain reaction which finally resulted in his death. She herself was suffering the after effects of a major hormone spill. The technical term for it was shock, and one of the commonest symptoms of shock was thirst. She should probably count herself lucky that her mouth was no drier than it was, at least so far, and maybe that's the one thing I can do something about. Gerald was the quintessential creature of habit, and one of his habits was keeping a glass of water on his side of the shelf above the headboard of the bed. She twisted her head up and to the right, and yes, there it was, a tall glass of water with a little cluster of melting ice cubes floating on top. The glass was no doubt sitting on a coaster so it wouldn't leave a ring on the shelf. That was Gerald, so considerate about the little things. Beads of condensation stood out on the glass like sweat. Looking at these, Jessie felt her first pang of real thirst. It made her lick her lips. She slid to the right as far as the chain on the left handcuff would allow. This was only 6 inches, but it brought her onto Gerald's side of the bed. The movement also exposed several dark spots on the left side of the coverlet. She stared at these vacantly for several moments before remembering how Gerald had voided his bladder in his last agony. Then she quickly turned her eyes back to the glass of water. Sitting up there on a round of cardboard which probably advertised some brand of yuppie suds, Beck's or Heineken being the most likely. She reached out and up, doing it slowly, willing her reach to be long enough. It wasn't. The tips of her fingers stopped 3 inches short of the glass. The pang of thirst, a slight tightening in the throat, a slight prickle on the tongue, came and went again. If no one comes or I can't think of a way to wiggle free by tomorrow morning, I won't even be able to look at that glass. This idea had about it a cold reasonableness that was terrifying in and of itself. But she wouldn't still be here tomorrow morning. That was the thing. The idea was totally ridiculous. Insane, as a matter of fact. Loopy. Not worth thinking about. It... Stop, the no-bullshit voice said. Just stop. And so she did. The thing she had to face was that the idea wasn't totally ridiculous. She refused to accept or even entertain the possibility that she could die here. That was Loopy, of course. But she could be in for some long, uncomfortable hours if she didn't dust away the cobwebs on the old thinking machine and get it running. Long, uncomfortable, and maybe painful, the good wife said nervously. But the pain would be an act of atonement, wouldn't it? After all, you brought this on yourself. I hope I'm not being tiresome, but if you just let him shoot his squirt... You are being tiresome, Goody, Jessie said. She couldn't remember if she had ever spoken out loud to one of the interior voices before. She wondered if she was going mad. She decided she didn't give much of a shit one way or another, at least for the time being. Jessie closed her eyes again. This time it wasn't her body she visualized in the darkness behind her lids, but this whole room. Of course she was still the centerpiece, gosh, yes, Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame. Still a shade under 40, still fairly trim at 5'6 and 125 pounds. Blue eyes, brownish-red hair. She covered the gray that had begun to show up about 5 years ago with a glossy rinse and was fairly sure Gerald had never known. Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame, who had gotten herself into this mess without quite knowing how or why. Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame, now presumably the widow of Gerald, still mother of no one, and tethered to this goddamn bed by 2 sets of police handcuffs. She made the imaging part of her mind zoom in on these last. A furrow of concentration appeared between her closed eyes. 4 cuffs in all, each pair separated by 6 inches of rubber-sleeved steel chain, each with M17, a serial number, she assumed, stamped into the steel of the lock plate. She remembered Gerald telling her, back when the game was new, that each cuff had a notched take-up arm, which made the cuff adjustable. It was also possible to shorten the chains until a prisoner's hands were jammed painfully together, wrist to wrist. But Gerald had allowed her the maximum length of chain. And why the hell not, she thought now. After all, it was only a game. Right, Gerald? Yet now her earlier question occurred to her, and she wondered again if it had ever really been just a game for Gerald. What's a woman? Some other voice, a UFO voice, whispered softly from some well of darkness deep inside her. A life support system for a cunt. Go away, Jessie thought. Go away, you're not helping. But the UFO voice declined the order. Why does a woman have a mouth and a cunt? It asked instead. So she can piss and moan at the same time. Any other questions, little lady? No. Given the unsettlingly surreal quality of the answers, she had no other questions. She rotated her hands inside the cuffs. The scant flesh of her wrists dragged against the steel, making her wince. But the pain was minor and her hands turned easily enough. Gerald might or might not have believed that a woman's only purpose in life was to serve as a life support system for a cunt, but he hadn't tightened the cuffs enough to hurt. She would have balked at that even before today, of course. Or so she told herself. And none of the interior voices were mean enough to dispute her on the subject. Still, they were too tight to slip out of. Or were they? Jessie gave them an experimental tug. The cuffs slid up her wrists as her hands came down, and then the steel bracelets wedged firmly against the junctions of bone and cartilage where the wrists made their complex and marvelous alliances with her hands. She yanked harder. Now the pain was much more intense. She suddenly remembered the time Daddy had slammed the driver's side door of their old country squire station wagon on Maddie's left hand, not knowing she was sliding out on his side for a change instead of on her own. How she had screamed. It had broken some bone, Jessie couldn't remember the name of it. But she did remember Maddie proudly showing off her soft cast and saying, "I also tore my posterior ligament." That had struck Jess and Will funny, because everyone knew that your posterior was the scientific name for your sit-upon. They had laughed, more in surprise than in scorn, but Maddie had gone storming off just the same, her face as dark as a thundercloud, to tell Mommy. Posterior ligament, she thought, deliberately applying more pressure in spite of the escalating pain. Posterior ligament and radio ulnar something or other. Doesn't matter. If you can slip out of these cuffs, I think you better do it, Toots, and let some doctor worry about putting Humpty back together again later on. Slowly, steadily, she increased the pressure, willing the handcuffs to slip down and off. If they would just go a little way, a quarter of an inch might do it, and a half was almost for sure. She would be past the bulkiest ridges of bone and would have more yielding tissue to deal with. Or so she hoped. There were bones in her thumbs, of course, but she would worry about them when and if the time came. She pulled down harder, her lips parting to show her teeth in a grimace of pain and effort. The muscles on her upper arms now stood out in shallow white arcs. Sweat began to bead her brow, even the slight indentation of her philtrum below her nose. She poked out her tongue and licked off this last without being aware of it. There was a lot of pain, but the pain wasn't what caused her to stop. What did was the simple realization that she had gotten to the point of maximum pull her muscles would provide, and it hadn't moved the cuffs a whit further down than they were right now. Her brief hope of simply squeezing out of this flickered and died. "Are you sure you pulled as hard as you could? Or are you maybe only kidding yourself a little because it hurts so much?" "No," she said, still not opening her eyes. "I pulled as hard as I could, really." But that other voice remained, actually more glimpsed than heard, something like a comic book question mark. There were deep white grooves in the flesh of her wrists, below the pad of the thumb, across the back of the hand, and over the delicate blue tracings of vein below, where the steel had bitten in. And her wrists continued to throb painfully, even though she had taken off all the pressure of the cuffs by raising her hands until she could grip one of the headboard slats. "Oh, boy," she said, her voice shaky and uneven. "Doesn't this just suck the big one?" Had she pulled as hard as she could? Had she really? Doesn't matter, she thought, looking up at the shimmers of reflection on the ceiling. Doesn't matter, and I'll tell you why. If I am capable of pulling harder, what happened to Maddie's left wrist when the car door slammed on it is going to happen to both of mine. Bones are going to break. Posterior ligaments are going to snap like rubber bands. And radio ulnar hoojiggies are going to explode like clay pigeons in a shooting gallery. The only thing that would change is that instead of lying here chained and thirsty, I'd be lying here chained, thirsty, and with a pair of broken wrists thrown into the bargain. They'd swell, too. What I think is this. Gerald died before he ever had a chance to climb into the saddle. But he fucked me good and proper just the same. Okay. What other options were there? None, Goodwife Burlingame said in the watery tone of a woman who is just a teardrop away from breaking down completely. Jessie waited to see if the other voice, Ruth's voice, would weigh in with an opinion. It didn't. For all she knew, Ruth was floating around in the office water cooler with the rest of the loons. In any case, her abdication left her to fend for herself. So, okay, fend, she thought. What are you going to do about the handcuffs, now that you've ascertained simply slipping out of them is impossible? What can you do? There are two handcuffs in each set. The young voice, the one she hadn't found a name for, spoke up hesitantly. You've tried to slip out of the ones with your hands inside them, and it didn't work. But what about the others? The ones hooked to the bedposts. Have you thought about them? Jessie pressed the back of her head into her pillow and arched her neck so she could look at the headboard and the bedposts. The fact that she was looking at these things upside down barely registered. The bed was smaller than a king or a queen, but quite a bit larger than a twin. It had some sort of fancy name, court jester size maybe, or chief lady-in-waiting. But she found it harder and harder to keep track of such things as she got older. She didn't know if you called that good sense or encroaching senility. In any case, the bed on which she now found herself had been just right for screwing, but a little too small for the two of them to share comfortably through the night. For her and Gerald, that hadn't been a drawback, because they had slept in separate rooms, both here and in the Portland house for the last 5 years. It had been her decision, not his. She had gotten tired of his snoring, which seemed to get a little worse every year. On the rare occasions when they had overnight guests down here, she and Gerald slept together, uncomfortably, in this room. But otherwise, they had shared this bed only when they had sex. And his snoring hadn't been the real reason she had moved out. It had just been the most diplomatic one. The real reason had been olfactory. Jessie had first come to dislike and then actually loathe the aroma of her husband's night sweat. Even if he showered just before coming to bed, the sour smell of Scotch whiskey began to creep out of his pores by 2 the next morning. Until this year, the pattern had been increasingly perfunctory sex followed by a period of drowsing. This had actually become her favorite part of the whole business, after which he would shower and leave her. Since March, however, there had been some changes. The scarves and the handcuffs, particularly the latter, had seemed to exhaust Gerald in a way plain old missionary-style sex never had, and he often fell deeply asleep next to her, shoulder to shoulder. She didn't mind this. Most of these encounters had been matinees, and Gerald smelled like plain old sweat instead of a weak scotch and water afterwards. He didn't snore much either, come to think of it. But all those sessions, all those matinees with the scarves and the handcuffs, were in the Portland house, she thought. We spent all of July and most of August down there. But on the occasions when we had sex, there weren't many, but there were some. It was just plain old pot roast and mashed potatoes kind. Tarzan on top, Jane on the bottom. We never played the game down here until today. Why was that, I wonder? Probably it had been the windows, which were too tall and oddly cut for drapes. They had never gotten around to replacing the clear glass with reflective sheets, although Gerald had continued to talk about doing that right up to, well, right up until today, Goody finished, and Jessie blessed her tact. And you're right. It probably was the windows, at least mostly. He wouldn't have liked Fred Lagland or Jamie Brooks driving in to ask on the spur of the moment if he wanted to play 9 holes of golf, and seeing him boffing Mrs. Burlingame, who just happened to be attached to the bedpost with a pair of Krieg handcuffs. Word on something like that would probably get around. Fred and Jamie are good enough fellows, I guess. A couple of middle-aged pukes, if you ask me, Ruth broke in sourly. But they're only human, and a story like that would have been too good not to talk about. And there's something else, Jessie. Jessie didn't let her finish. This wasn't a thought she wanted to hear articulated in the goodwife's pleasant but hopelessly prissy voice. It was possible that Gerald had never asked her to play the game down here because he had been afraid of some crazy joker popping out of the deck. What joker? Well, she thought, let's just say that there might have been a part of Gerald that really did believe a woman was just a life support system for a cunt, and that some other part of him, one I would call Gerald's better nature, for want of a clearer term, knew it. That part could have been afraid that things might get out of control. After all, isn't that just what happened? It was a hard idea to argue with. If this didn't fit the definition of out of control, Jessie didn't know what did. She felt a moment of wistful sadness and had to restrain an urge to look back toward the place where Gerald lay. She didn't know if she had grief in her for her late husband or not, but she did know that if it was there, this wasn't the time to deal with it. Still, it was nice to remember something good about the man with whom she had spent so many years, and the memory of the way he had sometimes fallen asleep beside her after sex was a good one. She hadn't liked the scarves, and had come to loathe the handcuffs, but she had liked looking at him as he drifted off, had liked the way his lines smoothed out of his large pink face. And in a way, he was sleeping beside her again right now. Wasn't he? That idea chilled even the flesh of her upper thighs, where the narrowing patch of sun lay. She turned the thought aside, or at least tried to, and went back to studying the head of the bed. The posts were set in slightly from the sides, leaving her arms spread but not uncomfortably so, particularly with the 6 inches or so of free play afforded by the handcuffed chains. There were 4 horizontal boards running between the posts. These were also mahogany, and engraved with simple but pleasing wave shapes. Gerald had once suggested that they have their initials carved in the center board. He knew of a man in Tashmore Glen would be happy to drive over and do it, he said. But she had poured cold water on the idea. It seemed both ostentatious and strangely childish to her, like teeny bop sweethearts carving hearts on their study hall desks. The bed shelf was set above the topmost board, just high enough to ensure that no one sitting up suddenly would bump his or her head. It held Gerald's glass of water, a couple of paperbacks left over from the summer, and on her end a little strew of cosmetics. These were also left over from the summer gone by, and she supposed they were dried out by now. A real shame, too. Nothing cheered up a handcuffed woman more reliably than a little country morning rose blusher. All the women's magazines said so. Jessie lifted her hands slowly, holding her arms out at a slight angle so her fists wouldn't fetch up on the underside of the shelf. She kept her head back, wanting to see what happened on the far end of the chains. The other cuffs were clamped to the bedposts between the second and third headboards. As she lifted her fisted hands, looking like a woman bench-pressing an invisible barbell, the cuffs slid along the posts until they reached the next board up. If she could pull that board off and the one above it, she would be able to simply slip the handcuffs off the ends of the bedposts. Voila! Probably too good to be true, hon. Too easy to be true. But you might as well give it a shot. It's a way to pass the time, anyway. She wrapped her hands around the engraved horizontal board, currently barring any further upward progress for the cuffs clamped to the bedposts. She took a deep breath, held it, and yanked. One hard tug was enough to tell her that that way was also blocked. It was like trying to pull a steel retaining rod out of a concrete wall. She could not feel even a millimeter's worth of give. I could yank on that bastard for 10 years and not even move it, let alone pull it off the bedpost, she thought, and let her hands fall back to their former slack, chain-supported position above the bed. A despairing little cry escaped her. To her it sounded like the caw of a thirsty crow. "What am I going to do?" she asked the shimmers on the ceiling, and at last gave way to desperate, frightened tears. "Just what in the hell am I going to do?" As if in answer, the dog began to bark again, and this time it was so close it scared her into a scream. It sounded, in fact, as if it was right outside the east window, in the driveway. The dog wasn't in the driveway. It was even closer than that. The shadow stretching up the asphalt almost to the front bumper of the Mercedes meant it was on the back porch. That long, trailing shadow looked as if it belonged to some twisted and monstrous freak show dog, and she hated it on sight. "Don't be so damn silly," she scolded herself. "The shadow only looks that way because the sun's going down. Now open your mouth and make some noise, girl. It doesn't have to be a stray after all." True enough. There might be a master in the picture somewhere, but she didn't hold out much hope for the idea. She guessed that the dog had been drawn to the back porch by the wire-covered garbage bin just outside the door. Gerald had sometimes called this tidy little construction, with its cedar shingles on top and its double latches on the lid, their raccoon magnet. This time it had drawn a dog instead of a coon, that was all. A stray, almost certainly. An ill-fed, down-on-its-luck mutt. Still, she had to try. "Hey!" she screamed. "Hey, is anyone there? I need some help if you are."
Is anyone there?
The dog stopped barking instantly. Its spidery, distorted shadow jerked, turned, started to move, and then stopped again. She and Gerald had eaten sub sandwiches on the ride up from Portland, big, oily salami and cheese combos, and the first thing she'd done when they arrived was to gather up the scraps and wrappings and dump them into the garbage bin. The rich smell of oil and meat was probably what had drawn the dog in the first place, and it was undoubtedly the smell which kept it from bolting back to the woods at the sound of her voice. That smell was stronger than the impulses of its feral heart.
Help!
Jessie screamed. And part of her mind tried to warn her that screaming was probably a mistake, that she would only scrape her throat raw and make herself thirstier. But that rational, cautioning voice never had a chance. She had caught the stink of her own fear. It was as strong and compelling to her as the smell of the sandwich leftovers were to the dog, and it quickly carried her into a state that was not just panic, but a kind of temporary insanity.
Help me! Somebody help me! Help! Help! Help!
Her voice broke at last, and she turned her head as far to the right as it would go, her hair plastered to her cheeks and forehead in sweaty licks and tangles, her eyes bulging. The fear of being found chained up naked with her husband lying dead on the floor beside her had ceased to even be a casual factor in her thinking. This new panic attack was like some weird mental eclipse. It filtered out the bright light of reason and hope, and allowed her to see the most awful possibilities of all. Starvation, thirst-induced madness, convulsions, death. She was not Heather Locklear or Victoria Principal, and this was not a made-for-TV suspense movie on the USA cable network. There were no cameras, no lights, no director to call cut. This was happening, and if help didn't come, it might well go on happening until she ceased to exist as a life form. Far from worrying about the circumstances of her detention, she had reached a point where she would have welcomed Maury Povich and the entire film crew of A Current Affair with tears of gratitude. But no one answered her frantic cries. No caretaker down here to check his places by the lake. No curious local out rambling with his dog, and perhaps trying to discover which of his neighbors might be growing a little marijuana among the whispering pines. And certainly not Maury Povich. There was only that long, queerly unpleasant shadow, which made her think of some weird dog spider balancing on four thin and febrile legs. Jessie took a deep, shuddery breath and tried to reestablish control over her skittish mind. Her throat was hot and dry, her nose uncomfortably wet and plugged with tears. What now? She didn't know. Disappointment throbbed in her head, temporarily too large to allow anything like constructive thought. The only thing of which she was completely sure was that the dog meant nothing. It was only going to stand out there on the back porch for a while and then go away when it realized that what had drawn it was out of reach. Jessie made a low, unhappy cry and closed her eyes. Tears oozed out from beneath her lashes and spilled slowly down her cheeks. In the late afternoon sun, they looked like drops of gold. What now? She asked again. The wind gusted outside, making the pines whisper and the loose door bang. What now, good wife? What now, Ruth? What now, all you assorted UFOs and hangers-on? Any of you? Any of us? Got any ideas? I'm thirsty. I need to pee. My husband is dead. And my only company is a woods dog whose idea of heaven is the leftovers of a three-cheese Genoa salami sub from Amato's in Gorham. Pretty soon it's going to decide that the smell is as close to heaven as it's going to get, and then it will bug out. So, what now? No answers. All the interior voices had fallen silent. That was bad. They were company, at least. But the panic had also gone, leaving only its heavy metal aftertaste. And that was good. I'll sleep for a while, she thought, amazed to find she could actually do just that if she wanted to. I'll sleep for a while, and when I wake up, maybe I'll have an idea. At the very least, I can get away from the fear for a while. the tiny strain lines at the corners of her closed eyes, and the two more noticeable ones between her brows began to smooth out. She could feel herself beginning to drift. She let herself go toward that refuge from self-regard with feelings of relief and gratitude. When the wind gusted this time, it seemed distant, and the restless sound of the door was even further away. Bang, bang. Bang, bang. Bang. Her breathing, which had been deepening and slowing as she slipped into a doze, suddenly stopped. Her eyes sprang open. The only emotion she was aware of in that first moment of sleep-snatched-away disorientation was a kind of puzzled pique. She had almost made it, damn it all, and then that damned door. What about that damned door? Just what about it? The damned door hadn't finished its usual double bang. That was what about it. As if this thought had brought them into being, Jessie now heard the distinctive click of the dog's toenails on the floor of the entryway. The stray had come in through the unlatched door. It was in the house. Her reaction was instant and unequivocal.
You get out!
She screamed at it, unaware that her overstrained voice had taken on a hoarse foghorn quality.
Get out, motherfucker! Do you hear me? You get the hell out of my house!
She stopped, breathing fast, eyes wide. Her skin seemed woven through with copper wires carrying a low electrical charge. The top two or three layers buzzed and crawled. She was distantly aware that the hairs on the nape of her neck were standing as erect as porcupine quills. The idea of sleep had disappeared right off the map. She heard the initial startled scrabble of the dog's nails on the entry floor. Then nothing. I must have scared it away. It probably scattered right out the door again. I mean, it's got to be afraid of people and houses, a stray like that.
I don't know, Toots, Ruth's voice said. It sounded uncharacteristically doubtful. I don't see its shadow in the driveway.
Of course you don't. It probably went right around the other side of the house and back into the woods, or down by the lake. Scared to death and running like hell. Doesn't that make sense?
Ruth's voice didn't answer. Neither did Goody, although at this point Jessie would have welcomed either one of them.
I did scare it away, she said. I'm sure I did. But still she lay there, listening as hard as she could, hearing nothing but the hushed thump of blood in her ears. At least, not yet.